And now, the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck Ochelli.
Okay, so for the first time in many years, I am broadcasting on a Saturday, that is. And I have not done this live in my time slot, I don't know, since I was on American Freedom Radio in the first couple of months, I think, which, what was that, 2015? I don't even remember. Anyway, this is not the normal show. So it is being recorded on, I think it's the 22nd of May, 2021. But this will be something a bit unique. Why? I'm going to discuss psilocybin, and it is from a personal perspective. This is by no means advice to anyone. This is merely personal revelation, personal experimentation, which, quite frankly, I conducted without the advice of anyone. And I did it to myself. Why? Because I feel as though, quite frankly, we all have the right to be our own guinea pig. And maybe I'm going to get into a few more reasons why this was absolutely necessary, and how it is that I am immensely grateful, grateful beyond description, really, to some people that made sure that I had the psilocybin to utilize. And they did it with some risk to themselves, as per usual, because we all know this is not a legal substance. Look, nobody charged me for it. It was gifted to me. I will under no circumstances reveal the individuals who did so, but I do know that some of them are going to hear this broadcast. And you guys don't know how you saved my life. Anyway, Captain Trips is with me, and this is just going to be a discussion between the two of us. Now, Captain Trips is an interesting character, has been on the show many times, and usually discusses many open topics, and gets into certain areas. We've had many a discussion about COVID and what's happening. Why? Because he does work in the medical field, and I think that he is just about the only medical practitioner who is professionally gainfully employed that I am familiar with, who I have any trust in. That is probably a weird sounding statement, considering the fact that, quite frankly, I have not met this man face to face.
One day
we're going to do that. Yeah. I'm sure.
We're gonna drag Joe out of the holler too at the same time.
Either that, or we'll all have to meet in his holler. I'm not sure.
Well, I think that's gonna be the more likely thing. I think it's a better chance of me driving to Georgia, picking you up, and driving to Kentucky than him leaving it.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking too. But you know what? One of these days, the three of us are definitely gonna sit down, and you know there might be a little alcohol involved in one of our sit downs for sure. But that's not going to be what it's about. It's because I made friends, and a lot of you, I feel like, are my friends. I don't really have day to day friends, to be honest with you. I have my family. I kind of know a few neighbors and this and that, but I don't really have friends face to face. Now that's an odd situation, and it's something that's happened to me over the past few years. But truthfully, that wasn't always the way I was. I always knew people. But anyway. Try to get some of the nervous energy out of myself here, because I want to approach this as seriously as possible, and we plan to do this in about three parts on a podcast. So now that I've laid all that out to everybody, I think I've set the stage pretty well. Captain Trips, first of all, man, how you doing? And as I said before, I in no means mean this as an advisory thing. I am not suggesting anybody follows my lead. I am not going to give particulars on certain aspects here of what went on, what resulted, and a few other things, only because I'm just telling you my story. I'm not telling anybody that this is advice, that this is solidly backed up by any sort of research of my own outside of the fact that basically I was given the means to make myself into my own guinea pig. And again, as I said, I'm extremely grateful to those that that made that situation happen. And the only advice that I had in play here from Captain Trips was an alert to him that if something went terribly, terribly wrong, we might have had Kim reach out to him, Mrs. O reach out to him, to find out what would be the step to take to deal with it. Because the fact is, look, there is always a danger when utilizing substances, even if they are natural, depending on the conditions. So that is the only thing. But he didn't sign off on this. This is not something he participated in. He was just told that, look, if something goes wrong, we might call you to find out what to do. You know, psychologically, if Chuck freaks out, you know, maybe we need a little advice. And what would you do in this situation? And I wanted Kim to have somebody to talk to. So that was the only thing, but by no means did he endorse this, participate in any way, shape, or form, outside of, you know, maybe messaging Kim during some of my experimentation and asking how I was doing. And that was about it. So, no, I'm trying to be as honest as possible but direct and make sure.
My particular area of practice is not in psychiatry. It's all currently it is neonatal intensive care, but it does. My past includes quite a few years practicing in various adult intensive care settings, and I'm currently adding some certification to get into family practice. Actually, integrative medicine for anyone who knows what I'm talking about, and this is this whole concept is something that, as Chuck said, I don't know enough about it. It's not a specialty area of mine. I have read a little bit about it because in the medical literature, it's appearing more and more in what, you know, what you would consider mainstream American medical literature, right. And being used with quite a bit of success for things like PTSD, some very refractory depressions. Even I'm looking now, it's a paper that I pulled just to have as a reference is talking about its use in treating obsessive compulsive behavior. So, it definitely has a place, and I think there are a lot of these things like psilocybin, and as we found out with cannabis over the last 20 years, aside from their recreational value, there's actually a ton of therapeutic value in so many of these things, and I think far beyond what the pharma ghouls have created in their labs and pushed out on people.
Well, let's make no mistake about that. And I've been bringing up the opioid situation, especially in recent weeks since I saw a certain documentary. Talked about it on Aaron's show last night, which I haven't put out the podcast yet, but I assure you there's a discussion between me and Aaron about that documentary. when one examines what pharmaceutical companies have done, it's not as though they discovered opium, but they kept repackaging it. And now we have the opioid crisis. We have people seeking out heroin because they can't get a hold of their pills. There's a lot to this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fight over cannabis over the years, interesting thing, because I've been an advocate of that all the way through. I think it's absolutely silly. It's a plant. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, I also know that its therapeutic value to me is minimal. That's a funny thing about this. Like, I advocate that for anyone, even if it's recreational, I don't care. It's a plant. Yeah.
It's a whole lot safer than the bottle.
Well, that's the thing. It is safer than alcohol, and I don't begrudge anybody drinking alcohol, to be honest with you.
No, not at all.
I'm just saying that I've advocated for something there, not because of my own personal experience, although it does have some medicinal values for me. It's not something that I integrate into my regular behaviors as far as cannabis goes. I smoke very little, and I smoke it. I've eaten it, you know, and I've found that that its medicinal value for me is not very high. You can have fun. You can have fun with a bottle of whiskey, too. And I love certain kinds of whiskey. We've talked about this. Anyway.
Yeah.
Mm. And the thing is that whiskey has also got medicinal value.
Yes, it does.
Anyhow, this is one of those areas, though, where we're still dealing with something that's not being accepted, except I think in Washington State now.
And actually, believe it or not, I think I'd have to look for sure, but you know, it all got lost in the mayhem of the elections. But the D.C. had a referendum on basically magic mushrooms, so psilocybin, mm-hmm. mescaline, and they were vote. It was a public referendum, and I thought it passed. Kind of like they did with cannabis, which was pretty much just across the board decriminalization.
Right.
I'm pretty sure that did pass in D.C. So, and then didn't Oregon just kind of lift all drug prohibition?
It's either Oregon or Washington. I can't remember which. One of them just said it's all decriminalized.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah, I mean, and Portugal did it. I remember I want to say it was 2005, and their kind of long term data following up was, a tremendous drop in obviously drug crimes were dropped and mm-hmm. Crime in general went down. I don't know how you could obtain it if it's just decriminalized or if you're buying it and paying a bunch of money to the state for the privilege of doing something.
There's still a lot of debate.
Rate, they had quite a success with just across the board decriminalization.
Well, I also found it interesting that not only in academia, medical academia, in psychiatry, that not only have they now begun to study this in a legitimate way, but I also read a news story about the Pentagon recently deciding to invest some millions of dollars into exploring whether this could assist troops, post-combat conditions.
They need to do something.
Which, again, we know that is something that needs to be done. Anyway, we're at a time period, though, where, frankly, it's still not legal. It's still not. It's something that grows in the ground, just like cannabis. Yep. And is easier to cultivate, I think, than cannabis is. I'm not entirely sure. But point is, again, as I stand as an advocate for cannabis, I don't. And here's the thing about me is that I want to live in a state where drug prohibition is gone. I would love to move there and deal with that because a whole lot of criminal activity disappears.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I'm not talking about this theoretically. I happen to know something about it directly. Okay. And truth is truth, man. So.
Mm-hmm.
The setup here is, I want you to be able to say whatever it is you want to say about this, and then I want to set up the basic reasons that I personally felt this was necessary, what was my condition a couple of months ago when I started, and I'm not done in my mind with what it is that I believe can be accomplished, but what was my state? What had brought me to a state of truly intolerable existence, quite frankly, and I'm going to talk about that pretty raw here in a minute. So, if you don't want to hear about this kind of thing, you're going to want to turn off the podcast right now because I'm going to discuss some traumatic stuff. I'm going to discuss a thumbnail sketch that gets you into a position where, quite frankly, my opinion was, even if this was something where people had warned me before, that psychedelics, if done in an excessive way, could do damage, and you could wreck your brain, and to me it was like, well, that is more acceptable. If I destroyed my brain, that would be more acceptable than continuing in the state I was in. But anyway, so I'm just giving you a heads up. You don't want to hear that kind of traumatic discussion, emotional stuff. I suggest you tune out. Anyway, Captain Trips, anything you want to say before we get into this?
No, I think I'm ready to go when you are.
Okay, but one more time, this is not advice. This is my story, and I want you, of course, to ask questions or to make relevant comments where you feel necessary. So believe it or not, usually I'm the one framing the conversation. Kind of going to turn that over to Captain Trips tonight. So we'll see how that goes.
I am by no means an interviewer, but I will do my best.
Well, neither am I.
I guess I am in some.
I just have a conversation with people. I don't really do standard interviews. I mean, sometimes you get parts of it where it's a standard interview, but it doesn't last long. You know, it goes back to a back and forth always.
And that's what makes your shows so much better than some of them, because they are definitely they flow better. And they don't sound, I know they're not scripted, but they don't even some stuff that's not scripted can still sound scripted, and that's never the case with your stuff. So
yeah, and still I try and get out information in a fairly orderly fashion, but through the course of a conversation that I direct. All right. So anyway, enough of the technique on the show. Here's the reality of the situation, right? The base for my trauma begins in my early childhood. And look, I've been through it enough times with court-appointed psychologists and psychiatrists because as a kid I got in trouble a lot. And believe me, they threw those people at me constantly. So I'd been through that. I had done my own independent reading. Again, you get locked in certain facilities, you can get your hands on books. You might read some. Anyway, so I'm aware that there could be an argument made that trauma begins, in utero. And it's a solid argument, which actually sort of dictates the way your neural pathways are established scientifically. And, you know, my mother was 16 years old, 15 when she got impregnated with me. She was a drug addict. She was somebody who did not, you know, live a calm life and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of times you could say that babies in utero experience their mother's experiences, because they're fed the hormones. They're fed whatever it is mama brings into the body. They have to share it. And, you know, so this doesn't end up being retained in your memory necessarily. And most people's memories don't begin until they're a few years old, because as a human, your neural pathways are not fully established for memory retention. However, there is another type of memory which has a technical term, but basically it comes down to this. A lot of times when you have sensations, unfounded feelings about certain things, or you have a particular disposition, scientifically this is argued that this comes from your experience in utero. And I know that there is some debate and dispute about that, but it does seem logical, likely, and we do know that much like, unlike other mammals, say, we don't have our full neurological function. There is formation still going on after you are born. You're not a horse. You don't get right up and walk. Many other animals that can just get up, walk, eat, move around, you're not able to do that because you're still cognitively impaired by development itself. So one could say that it would begin there, and I was born and immediately had to go through another trauma, which I have no memory of, but withdrawal from heroin was not a pleasant experience, I'm sure. As I'm sure circumcision is not a pleasant experience, but you have no memory of these things. You know, you laugh, but I mean, I'm serious. This is where the baseline of it comes from, right?
No, you're absolutely right. And I'll also throw in, there's without getting too into the weeds as far as current research and whatnot, but the field of epigenetics is a lot of what I think you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And epigenetics, for anyone who's not familiar, but it's basically now looking at how certain genes act based on the environment they are placed in. So,
right.
Assume that, for sake of argument, pretend there's a gene for lung cancer. And, you know, the epigenetic factor there would be cigarette smoking. So some people will smoke cigarettes their whole life and they'll, you know, they won't have any problem with lung cancer. Some people, I've known people that have died of lung cancer and they smoked for, you know, 15 years, 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I think a lot of, and there was a study, an old study done on, and I can't remember which European country, but it basically looked at women who were pregnant in this European country during World War II.
Right.
And they, you know, they, a lot of these people, you know, practically starved to death. But then they followed these children and how they, and they had a very high risk for obesity because the, you know, the stress of being, you know, the in utero stress of their mother starving, you know, affected them later in life, and they just ate everything. You know, they just had a very hard time with weight control because of the way their body and the way their bodies would store fat because they were developing at a time when they were starving.
Mm-hmm. Right, which means that it's not just about the psychological element, but in fact the epigenetic response, yeah. Which doesn't necessarily mean you're dictated to by your genes, but your genes and your stimulus that come together cause reactions and actually alter the genetic pattern. It's a give and a take. It's not, you know, program, set, go. So right. That's why I bring that part up. But do I have a memory of those things? No. In fact, my memory begins in a fairly pleasant place in my mind. Now, my perspective, again, I'm a child, so, you know, to me, all of what I'm about to describe is very, very normal, and then I've got to add on the facts of the circumstances that I wasn't exposed to. Okay. Both of my parents were, you know, were indulging in the drugs. I mean, they ran together to do that. My father had served in Vietnam and had been damaged by that, but also had come back with a drug addiction. And my mother shared in that with him. This is what they did. Now, when she got pregnant with me, she was 15, he was 20. And, you know, what I recall is around the time, I'm going to say I was maybe a year and a half to 2 years old, in that pocket is where my memory begins. And my memory begins pretty good. I recall my father always going to work, and I recall my mother basically didn't get out of bed most of the day. And that was pretty much my life. I sat there and I played and waited for my father to come home. That's what I did. And I can tell you about, you know, how he taught me how to read. And I've mentioned these things on the show, sure. You know, where he taught me to read and use newspapers and stuff like this. And, you know, every once in a while would give me sips of his beer and stuff like this. I got all kinds of memories, but they all come to an end when I'm 4 years old. My father commits suicide, and I wasn't directly exposed to that either. But very suddenly I'm living in my grandmother's house. My mother's still quite absorbed into her drug-addicted world. And I'm not even saying that as a moral judgment, mind you. This was just kind of the reality of it. Now, I didn't know about the drugs. I didn't know that my father was kind of a violent man. Never with me. And, you know, there was a loving relationship that was just instantaneously removed there. I think that would be my first instance of trauma. It's still painful. I wouldn't be surprised if I discuss some more details here if I don't choke up a bit. I don't think that wound will ever fully heal. Now, this isn't what gave me PTSD. This I would consider to be a particularly tragic and completely uncontrollable part of my life, where indeed, you know, I was supposed to be getting ready to go to school. You know, September 11, 1976 is when he decided to do this. And again, as I said, I was 4 years old. And life from that point on changed quite a bit. Now, the outside circumstances, stuff I didn't get to see. You know, I had this odd relationship with my mother where she didn't really seem to be all that interested in me. She kind of dragged me around to different places and brought me to things like, you know, like I've told the story on here about being in a bar room at six and wind up whacking a guy with a pool cue. You know, and that's a pleasant memory for me. That's, you know, that's the story I want to tell. But there was a lot that started to happen after my father's death that are stories that I didn't want to tell then. And, I still frankly, shudder at to tell now. Anyway, I'm in a different world from most other kids. Violence was a constant. The need to figure out a way to grab hold of things in order to survive was a constant. And I suffered, you know, violence from her. I suffered violence from the different men she brought in. I suffered... There are levels of physical abuse that I almost find laughable at this point in time. And even back then, I started to find them laughable after I got over the fact that this was going to be life. But there was... There are things that honestly, I'm sitting here choking on it, trying to get it out, that I went through.
It's all right. Take your time. Don't,
you know, to draw a thumbnail sketch is hard, but let's try and fast forward through part of it, because everything that is not necessarily just in this pocket, you know? And a lot of different things happened here where there were some good times where I ended up in some dangerous situations that turned out just fine. You know, wound up spending time in, not just in New Jersey, but in New York, in order to, you know, be a lookout and help out with things, so that, you know, so that, we could move drugs. Is what it came down to. So during a time when I had a lot of interesting injuries and I had to compartmentalize my life and tell stories to, you know, other kids that wanted to know how it is you end up getting beat up so bad, how it is that you disappeared for a while, how it is that, you know, you've fallen asleep because you've been up all night in Harlem until, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning, and you came back to get to school on time, you know, and never allowing any authorities, of course, to know any of this, because, first of all, if they got a hold of me, they were going to put me in a worse place than I was in, and secondly, that would probably be the only thing that would happen. Also, I was given to the idea that since I was participating in this, that, you know, they do make jails for kids. Now, I didn't realize that I probably could have gotten out of certain things. I mean, I wasn't dealing with the regular, polite, daylight world most of the time. So, between the time he died, and I'll just try to bring it up to about the age of 10 as quickly as I can. You know, there were situations that happened where there were sexual assaults. Some of them more violent than others. And some things which... would be deemed as sexual assaults that in my mind were just the course of doing business and were just part of that world. And, you know, there was other rough situations. There was a lot of different levels to this. Man. You know, I can usually discuss this and hold it together. I got to be honest with you. This is just...
No, it's fine. It's fine. I've just been letting you go because you've... I mean, you really have been... You've definitely been laying the groundwork. I mean, I think you could probably just... And I'm not telling you to do this, but I think you could probably just stop just at what you've told so far. And that could easily go the distance to explain why, you know, why using the means and the methods that you've just tried, you know, why you needed to. I think, you know,
some of this cuts very deep is what the point is. And yeah. Some of it that other people might think should have been deep and horrifying wasn't. I grew accustomed to certain things.
And that in and of itself is frightening. I mean, it takes a lot to desensitize people to the point where, you know, people would be horrified at, you know, hearing some of the things that you were desensitized to. So, you know, for you, it was just, you know, just another day at the office kind of thing.
Right. So, but what this does... It creates, you know, and look, I'm only going up to the age of 10 here when I'm talking about this stuff. By the time that happened, you know, I was, you know, various times I had been in handcuffs already, a few times, literally, you know, for my own actions. I had been snapped up and taken into places by, you know, by authorities and by other people that, you know, again, were doing some other kind of business. And I had lost control in a lot of cases. And I like telling the stories about when I was able to take control of a situation. I like those stories. I really do. But there was some brutality that I don't think I will ever share with another human being, not my wife, not my children, not anybody.
And you don't have to. Right? I mean, you know, that's...
It's just I'm rifling through this in my head.
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
And,
I'm sure.
You know,
you're making the point. You know, this is all. This is all from the ages of about 4 to 10,
yeah.
And you know the plasticity of the brain at that age is just remarkable. Going through the things that you know you and I have discussed off air, going through a quarter of some of those things in that age, you know, as your brain is so rapidly developing.
Well, and I learned a lot of skills.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, at a certain point, I don't know how I came up with it, but intuitively, I learned how to patch up people, you know, on the positive side.
Battlefield medicine.
I actually started to, yeah, I mean, effectively, with the right magnification, the right tools, and, you know, a well-stocked toolbox, basically. You know, I saved people from having to go to the emergency room but didn't want to be seen.
yeah.
You know, patched up certain things, brought people out of ODs. I failed a few times, but brought people out of ODs. I did a lot of things with really just intuition, and I don't know where any of that came from. I mean, I did read up on physiology and stuff like that. And, you know, here we go. Here's another thing I learned how to do is, in short order, you know, if you go and buy bricks of heroin and you can make the product bigger, you can make money. So I was taught how to do that and a few other things. You know, I got lucky that... a guy who I would call a stepfather, I'm not going to name him here, but in my manuscript, I go into some detail about this guy. I got lucky that he died when I was 9, because at a certain point, I mean, you know, I was in a situation where I believed that my stepfather looking at me directly and telling me, you know what I'm going to do if you cause any more problems, like, you know, bringing attention our way as a kid, is, you know, I'm going to sell you to those black guys over there. They're going to turn you out. And, well, age of 9, I knew exactly what that meant. I took him very seriously, you know, and this kind of thing. There was more to that statement, but I'm just giving you an idea here. These are my authorities, right? And that started to change as we get past the age of 10, because he's dead. Again, luckily. But after run-ins with the law and all this kind of stuff, and my mother's world started to change a little. And she decided to start cleaning up after a couple of bodies dropped around her, and she decided she didn't want to die. So she turns around and in quick order gets involved with, you know, going to self-help programs and turning herself into a drug counselor after a long, arduous process of kicking dope and, you know, backsliding a little bit, what do they call it, relapsing. Okay, this kind of thing. Kept me on my toes for a little while. Are we in the criminal world, or are we going over to the other side here? Now we're going to play this game. And when that started to happen, I was already so well acquainted with what it is I had to do, even though we kept moving around to different places. Which was another thing, is that, you know, at that time, you could move from town to town in Jersey and be a couple towns away, and it was like you went into another world, because people weren't really connected across distances. So every couple of years or so, we would move. And sometimes, you know, more than once in a year or whatever. But there was moving between different towns. And so I lived all up and down the East Coast of the state. Really mainly focused in two counties, but that's irrelevant. Thing is, these different towns I'm in, every new circumstance created a new opportunity, disconnect, and anonymity for me. Each place I was going to, until I finally settled in one particular spot in my teen years. But the thing is that was all going on, and now I was pretty much in charge of myself. I'd gotten to a point where definitely nobody was going to put their hands on me without my explicit consent, and things like this. But it was a bizarre transition to me. How do you yank me a couple of months from, you know, survive at your best, do what you got to do, and, you know, carry a razor blade, because, you know, a small person can cut a larger person with a razor blade in a lot of different ways. How do you go from that and, you know, to, well, now mom has a job, and what you're going to do is behave as though somebody's in charge of you and actually gives a damn. It didn't work out well. And again, I made a lot of bad decisions and was further put through some things by getting locked up in different places. And quite frankly, I don't know where anybody gets the idea that, you know, some mental hospitals are okay, and I ended up getting thrown into some of those, sometimes with a court order, sometimes, you know, because there were extenuating circumstances connected to something I had done or whatever. But that, along with what I would satisfactorily call a dungeon, which is a juvenile detention center in New Jersey, you know, were also fairly harsh circumstances I had to get through. And I did, you know, dumb things too. I mean, like, clearly only reason why I would ever get caught at stuff is because I would lose my temper. And that was something that I had a hard time controlling, especially when somebody would trigger it and things like this. And I gotta say that even trying to deal with that world, where, you know, I brought things onto myself, I feel like, at that point. And a little bit of maturity kicks in as I go forward. And I try to get out of that, and I try to change all that. And what I want to do is devote myself to being a musician. And I am determined to finish high school, because neither one of my parents did that. Just make my way in the world, my way. And I tried to lay down all the criminality and embrace the idea that violence, whether I'm doing it to myself or people around me or I'm doing it for profit, is not a good solution. And I stumbled a bit doing that, and deserved to be incarcerated. But as time wore on, I moved past that. Now, there's a lot of circumstances here that I didn't get into, but, I mean, there were points at which, you know, I thought my life was over. Pretty much, okay, I'm dead. This is gonna kill me. And things did not. And I transitioned from being a young kid, waking up, being surprised I woke up, and being happy I woke up, to starting to be disappointed that I would survive. Everything from being shot at to, you know, car accidents to, you know, somebody is literally coming at you, and by all rights, by all circumstances, your life is about to end, and somehow I walk away. And again, some of this stuff I brought on myself. In my teen years, I absolutely own it. I know what I did. But earlier in life, that was just the world. So why do I bring all this up? I think it's to explain that my start point in life is from a different angle than most of the people I ever encounter. They're not, I mean, even when your parents are criminals, and I mean prolific criminals, I don't know, it's funny, it's like most times the prolific criminals will protect their children from it, you know, to where they're not really fully, you know, you always see the thing on the documentary, yeah, I knew my dad had friends, and they were, you know, doing something, but I didn't know anything until the FBI kicked in the door.
Yeah, you never asked questions when this certain uncle would come over. Yeah. I came from a very similar, in that respect, mm-hmm. It came from a similar background.
But there was a quiet like that where the kids were kind of kept out of it, where it was like, you know, remove them from this. Whereas I feel like I was being trained, you know, not like anybody said, okay, we're going to train this kid how to do this. But I mean, just basically life was saying, you know, when it comes down to it, this is the way you're going to have to survive, and you better learn. Which I had, an Italian businessman, a wise guy kind of guy, who took me on as a mascot at one point and literally told me that. And it was one of the most, you know, aha moments I ever had, where something made sense, where it was like, you need to learn to take care of yourself. Not everybody can do this, but you need to. So this sets me into a different mindset, is all I'm saying, trying to go through my developmental years, right? And it gets stranger after that too, you know. There are other traumatic incidents that come up, and the first time I got diagnosed with the PTSD was, again, court-appointed psychologist, sitting there, and, you know, I'm 10, and they're like, well, it's amazing, but what you have is the same type of symptoms that, you know, somebody has from battlefield condition, except you're you're effectively, we study adult children of alcoholics, I believe was the phrase they used. And, you know, and they're like, same thing as drug addicts, but, you know, adult children of alcoholics, this is, they go through a certain type of trauma, and they came at me from that angle and started to discover that I was displaying, you know, things like nightmares and paranoia and certain triggered reactions and stuff like this. And they kind of came up with this scale around that time, which was like 1982, that as far as I know, it was new because a lot of Vietnam vets, including my father, there really wasn't much help for them. And he suffered from PTSD, and I have memories of that, too, not just of him teaching me how to read, but of him sweating in the middle of the night and, you know, things like this. But again, that was normal to me. So this is where life starts. I have that at 10. You know, so anything after that kind of gets added on to it. And of course, I suffered from depression, and I'm not doing this to cry poor me. Because for the most part, you know, outside of some of the really deep horrors of certain things, which, you know, at an early age, I understood that death was not necessarily a bad thing. And there were way worse things that could happen to you than a lot of things that happened to me. I always reasoned that way. But it's not as though it doesn't do some damage. It doesn't leave you with some scars. So moving forward, though, into adulthood, you know, made some mistakes where, yeah, there was a point at which I was doing well on my own and making my own way, but there was also a point at which I kind of fell and couldn't produce for a little while, ended up homeless. You know, and that's a very difficult situation to dig yourself out of, or at least it used to be. I don't know if it still is, but seems as though a cycle like that is very difficult, especially when basically you have no family or anybody that you can rely on. And people that call themselves your friends, you know, they come and go real fast through my life. That's another thing, is that quite frankly, I never maintained long-term relationships. I believe it's all because of me. and that's the reality here, is that if you last 5 years, and I'm old, you know, I'm 49 now, if you last 5 years just being in touch with me, you that's about the limit for anybody in my life, 5 years. Most people do not survive even close to that long in my circle, so to speak. One way or another, it's something that doesn't go on. So anyway, And another weird thing is that despite having suffered a lot of, I don't know if it's a lot. You know, here we go. You want me to tell you a strange thing about my scale of what's a lot and what's not a lot? Is, you know, thinking about the fact that there are many dozens of times that that I was sexually assaulted. But really, it only comes down to about maybe literally 6 times that there was excessive violence involved. That didn't seem like the worst thing that could have happened. You know, people complain about how their parents physically disciplined them. I had bones broken. I had serious injuries. One of them, my skull fractured. Which I do believe caused me some level of brain damage. And, I mean, I've seen that documented in when somebody's taking a look at, you know, done an MRI of my brain, that did occur. And it's a factor. I had my knee rendered useless, you know, again, all this stuff going on before I'm 10, right? You know, the violent rape situations, really that only occurred in my 6th year, all of them. after that, there wasn't so much violence, but there was still some more of it. But to me, again, I kind of felt like everybody must go through something like this or worse. So I guess you factor all that in with the fact that, you know, and here's another thing I don't like to cry about at all. You know, I am a disabled person. I have very little eyesight. I've always had very little eyesight. So this, this gave me a different walk through life than some people. Again, I'm just happy to not be blind. But I've got probably about 10% of the vision of an average person, and that's the best that I can be brought to. Frankly, without any correction on my face, most eye doctors can't even measure where my vision is because there's so little of it. So I'm just saying, traveling through the early part of my life, there was plenty of trauma and a lot of things that I'm not going to lay out piece by piece here. And I'm almost at the end of the first hour, which normally I would take a break. I think I may do that just so I can gather my thoughts. Because this is childhood trauma. But then there's more things that have gone on that man, none of it helps. None of it helps. And then I got to bring you all the way to 2021, don't I? Which, gee, I turned 18. Let me think about that. I was, it was 1990. So I got to bring it from 1990 to 2021, don't I? To explain all of where I'm at. Because I'm not just trying to have a catharsis here and vent. I'm trying to just give you the broad strokes of where it is I came from. And how it got me to a point I was at a few months ago. So I'm sorry, Captain Trips. I haven't really let you ask a lot of questions here, but I'm trying to do this so that, you know, there's a clear understanding of, you know, it's not, wow, I'm sad. Okay.
No. You did an excellent job of setting the stage as to why it was necessary to have the experience that you did. I think, even a fraction of what you went through, especially through those ages of 4 to 10, I've commented to you off air, I think it's remarkable you're in as good shape as you're in. That's not meant to be offensive or
no, I got you.
What you've gone through, and you're not in jail. You're not, you're not lying in a ditch somewhere. That just says a lot. Because a lot of people wouldn't have been able to pull themselves out and up, and you did.
Well, and a lot of people that are, you know, sitting in prisons for, you know, many violent crimes. On death row, I kind of said this in one of the rough manuscripts I've written about my life, which you know, isn't out yet, but is being worked on. You know, there are plenty of these kind of stories on death row. This is how you make somebody into a predator, usually. And I probably could have went that way.
I think easily,
but I didn't. You know, now does that mean that I lived a clean life after I went into adulthood? No. I got to tell you, there's more to it. Stuff I got myself into and stuff the world just seemed to keep dishing out at me. Like I said, I mean, I gave a hint about being a young adult and going from having my own way to live and everything else to being on the street and being invisible. Which is another experience, which I assure you is traumatic if you haven't gone through it yourself. Just being homeless, you know, for a couple of years. Try that. It doesn't work well. It doesn't do good for the soul, you know. Maybe this is why I have so many sympathies that, you know, some people like to criticize when I'm analyzing certain things where it's like, why do you always have a... You know what? Because I realize that despite your best efforts and intentions, despite who you think you are in your heart, if circumstances turn on you, you know, I know Christians love to say, there but for the grace of God. No, there but for the turn of one wrong circumstance is your ass in a prison cell, on a street, at the wrong end of somebody's weapon, at the wrong end of a violent assault, there but for just a mild circumstance change or two in your life. And you know what? Sometimes those things multiply upon themselves. They continue to grow and fester because getting into one bad situation causes you to get into more. And being in violent circumstances causes more violence. Mm-hmm. And that is a reality that I think a lot of people who never had to make their own way in the world without the benefit of anybody's help, some people don't understand this at all. And you know what? I say this, and it's going to sound strange coming from me, but bless you. I am so glad you don't know what this is. I can't express that any more than I just did. I'm grateful if you have no idea what I'm talking about. I really am. But there is a segment of society where it may not be out front. Sometimes it makes the headlines because it's salacious and it sells, whatever. But it's not the reality that most people live in. And can be going on right around you and you don't see it. I promise you that too.
No, there's a whole world that exists out of the view of everyday people.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I think I am going to take that break, though. And I want to get you into some more questions and things in the next hour. But it took me a little while to go through that. And I had to, I don't know if you noticed, but you can hear me stopping. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm only going to go so far. But, you know, a lot of blood, a lot of bodies, a lot of violence, a lot of trying to deal with internally why it is that you've been selected for certain things, why it is that somebody targeted you, why it is that you wind up bleeding. I mean, look, the whole reason why I don't let people call me Charles, to be honest with you, is because the way that I see it psychologically, and this is gonna get into the second part of this, okay. which we're not doing tonight, but a hint at it is that I don't allow people to call me Charles because, to my mind, that was a boy that bled to death on a street already. And
interesting.
I can't allow that name. That's not me. But you know what? People called me by a few different names at different points in the life that I've been talking to you about here. I was at one point called Charles. I was at one point called Charlie. I was at one point called Glasses, in fact, by some people. I smile when I say that one. But, you know, the reason why I say, look, if you're my friend, you call me Chuck, is because that's something that I chose to be called, and I know it's a very minor difference, but, you know, it may have some other psychological significance. And we're going to get into the psychology and a couple other things that cause the need for this experimentation when I come back. Captain Trips, thanks for hanging
yes,
with me, and we're gonna do a little more after I collect my thoughts, okay?
Sounds good.
All right. Stick around, guys. We'll be right back.
The views expressed by callers, co-hosts, or anyone else who happens to get on the air at Ocelli.com do not necessarily reflect the views of Ocelli.com or Chuck Ocelli, and we are not responsible for any stupidity which might ensue.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
So, second hour of this very special Saturday broadcast, which will be preserved as a podcast and hopefully will be the first part of three about the psilocybin experiment, which I conducted on myself. And all I've done so far is lay down the groundwork regarding childhood trauma, my personal story. Broad strokes, really. There are a lot of details. There are a lot of things I could put in there. But I think moving on is best to get into, well, you know, how is it that you live afterwards if you survive, right? And believe me, I survived a bunch of stuff that, I don't know, I got to tell you that quite often I've thought to myself and anybody who's gotten to know me and gotten to know just, you know, a fraction of what it is I've gone through, many of them have said, you know, not sure why you're still here.
I think I just said that.
Yeah, and Captain Tripp said that. And, you know, and I've shared stuff with you. Again, you know, I know we haven't been face-to-face, but you're mm-hmm. you're my friend. And
agree.
I've let you into some things that, I got to be honest with you, there are people that know me for more years than you that don't know, you know. And I'm doing this on air tonight, really bearing more of my underbelly, I guess, than I actually want to. But I feel it's necessary to explain where I was at and how I got there. So I'm going to continue on with the story, but at a certain point here, I want to get through a few things quickly and get us from 1990 to 2021 quickly.
Okay.
And when I do that, you know, I would like you to, you know, ask whatever objective questions. Don't worry about offending me or digging into the wrong place. Just do it.
Okay.
Because I feel that transparency on this is best. So
yeah,
one could say that, you know, okay, so I got a stumbling beginning in life and I graduate high school, which, again, as I said, was one of those things I set myself to do. Because really, life taught me that willpower was the only thing I had. So I could overcome many circumstances by sheer will. So I did that. And again, I don't want to hyper-focus on being handicapped, but quite honestly, look, it's difficult to get work. It's difficult to have people take you seriously if they know that you have a disability. Now, I don't, you know, have a wheelchair. And I've never used a dog, although I wouldn't mind having one as a guide. Never had the white. I mean, I've been taught how to use the white cane with the red tip, but and had to cross the street without being able to see and things like this. I do know how to function as a blind person. I'm not completely blind, but, you know, by law, I'm a blind person. And any state in the union will recognize that. So my life experience, not always easy. And again, without any sort of family backing or really, again, long-term relationships that stick, you know, it's kind of amazing that I was able to have romantic relationships. And quite frankly, I think that this is really weird and personal sounding, but the fact is that I feel as though it's women that cared about me, that taught me how to deal with a relationship to anybody without it being transactional. You know, and coming out of some of this stuff is not easy. You don't make friends easy. You don't trust people for sure ever. And things like that. And I got to tell you, I don't think I've ever really fully trusted hardly anyone in my life at all, no matter who they were, who they said they were, whether they said they loved me or they didn't. Generally speaking, I never believed them. But still, I would go on. And at a certain point, being homeless sucked, you know, as a young man. I was able to pull things together, end up, you know, making a living as a musician for a while, which is not an easy way of life. But I don't count it as a trauma, but something I picked for myself, probably ill-advised, for a while. And I made my way doing things in a lot of different ways. You know, different odd jobs. And when I made my living in music, it wasn't just as a performer, right? So I had to, you know, I was a bouncer. I was a door guy. I was a booker. I was a manager. I was, you know, in some cases, a basic bar back. Not a bartender, but just somebody who would handle the stupid things like draft beers, stuff like this. And this is how I made my way through the world for a bit. And I had different relationships, as I said. I had, you know, I had several girlfriends in high school, you know, and oddly, I had, in my mind anyway, that's another thing, since I did focus on the sexual trauma early on, I would say that despite all that, relatively normal sexually, you know, I'm a heterosexual guy. I never prostituted myself. You know, I didn't go down any of those roads that you know, that a lot of people that have been victims do. Mm-hmm. I didn't become predatory or aggressive sexually or any of that. You know, so relatively normal. I might have a couple of quirks, but I'm not...
Don't we all.
Not out of line, okay? You know, anyways. So, there's that. And I go through adulthood. So, some other bad things start to happen. You know, I didn't keep almost anybody that, again, that I cared about. A lot of them died along the way. You know, I have a chapter in the manuscript I'm working on, which I call My Seven Mothers. And that is because at certain points in my life, I had what I would call surrogate mothers, because I really didn't get mothering from my own mother. So almost all of them are dead, with the exception of, two of them. Two out of seven are alive. And I had nothing to do with anything that happened to any of them. It's just circumstances went this way. My Aunt Diane was a lovely woman, and she was one of them, and she passed away. I think I was about 30 years old. But any of these different women that came and gone, and you know, there's somebody that everybody who's listening to this would know her name, who counts as one of my seven mothers. Will
I was gonna ask if she was in the in that seven.
Oh, she is. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and here I am smiling, right? But I had friends take their lives. I had, you know, again, being a criminal adolescent, I got to be honest with you. There were certain people that I did think were my good friends, that were going to stick with me for life, and they're buried in different places. You know, they didn't make it. You know, the first girlfriend I ever had, she died when she was 21, in 1997. She was younger than me. Whole funny story about that, when we got together and all this, and she was like the first legitimate kind of relationship I had like that. And you know, I knew her for approximately 6 years, so there you go, there's somebody who broke the 5-year barrier, but just barely. You know, and but that's what I'm saying, is there was a constant cycling. And even my first marriage, which was a complete disaster, you know, after that I ended up in a position where my child support was stripping out all my income, and there was no way to live. So I danced back into criminality a little bit. Not violent criminality, but nonviolent drug offenses. You could have busted me for them. Not going to go into details, but did what I had to do to survive based on what I knew how to do. And I'm not a great guitar player, so I can't just sit down on the boardwalk and get dollars in my guitar case. I was a vocalist mainly, and I play bass, but who wants to hear a bass on the beach? Anyways. And there was a lot of rough patches here where, again, I didn't keep people in my life. I couldn't, one way or another. I don't know if that is all my fault or not, but it's something that I definitely did. Anyway, so there's other traumas here. I come home, I find one of my, I was living with a girlfriend. She was dead on the floor. I come home to find her. I had after my first wife, which was a disaster, I had a second wife who I loved very much, but I lost her very quickly. When she had a heart attack, she was a little bit older than me. There was, you know, different events that took place in my life where, no matter how I tried to avoid violence, it came to me anyway. There were circumstances by which, you know, I was in car accidents. A lot of car accidents, considering the fact that I never drive. You know, the first one I got into, I think I was like four. Or no, I was five. First time my head hits a windshield, I'm five. And, you know, and that's another thing, is I actually did suffer a bunch of different shots to the head over the course of my lifetime, which did literally cause some physical damage. As I said, the most profound one was when I was nine. I had my skull cracked. But I also had what they described finally as a severe cervical sprain, again with a head hitting the windshield. Another time I broke a bone in my neck. I walked around for a couple of days not knowing that it was broken because I just had this terrible headache. And I suffer from migraine headaches anyway, so I'm like, ah, it's one of my headaches. And plus, I had a car accident. So, you know, 3-4 days later, I walk into the ER, and they're like, well, this is a cervical fracture. You know, so translation, I broke my neck.
Yeah. you did.
You know, so, and there's another point at which I actually broke my back. Okay. Another, you know, that's a fracture of the thoracic vertebrae.
You broke your back.
I broke my back, and I ended up in traction. And so I went through a bunch of things that you could categorize as trauma, one way or another. And so where am I getting to? Well, you know, people who have been listening to my show, maybe they know that I had done the JFK research stuff. I mean, that gets mixed in there, too. Mm-hmm. You know, I had plenty of lives, let's say. In my lifetime. So, you know, yeah, at one point I was a musician. At one point I was a security guard. At one point I was a manager of multiple locations of convenience stores and gas stations. I have been just a guy working at the counter at 7-Eleven. I've been a glazier, a glass glazier, carrying, you know, hundreds of pounds of glass up ladders to affix it to buildings.
I didn't know about that one.
Yeah, I've done a lot of jobs. You know, and again, my whole life in music, where I did everything from work in studios to, you know, again, you see, you can hear me being proud of certain things. And,
definitely.
You know, and I worked in a deli, and I worked in, you know, I did all kinds of things. This is why, you know, just the other day, I'm in the doctor's office with Mrs. O, and the doctor says, well, what do you do for a living? And reflexively, I said, lots of things. Because that's the way I feel about it, is I've done a lot of different things in my life. Now, for the past several years, I've been devoted to this show. And there's a history to that. And when we do the 2000th episode, I'm going to talk to you guys about all that history and see if you care. But there's that, right? And obviously, after a series of many unfortunate events in New Jersey, I end up in a relationship with the current Mrs. O. And we left New Jersey together, and there's a whole story to that. But also not easy times. But I wouldn't count it as a traumatic. So here's the thing. For the past, let's see now, just about 8 years, you know, I've actually maintained a relationship longer than 5 years. You know, I've got my son here. I've been in his life longer than I was with either of my other two children who were, you know, summarily kind of separated from me. Again, I wouldn't count this as trauma. I would just count this as the unfortunate events of an adulthood, you know. But the
Your daughter's back. Is your daughter still living with you all?
Yeah, currently. I don't know if that's going to stay that way, but I mean, she's been here for a couple of months, but yeah. There were years in between last time I spoke to her and years in between that.
Yeah, because you just had your reunion with them not too long ago, right?
Exactly, yeah. Which, you know, again, November of last year, my older son called me because he was 18 and decided to do so. But anyway, again, like I'm saying, these are like normal adult miseries, right? And since being with Mrs. O, I got to tell you that, you know, we had some struggles. But you're not talking about oppressive misery. In any reasonable sense, you couldn't call it any sort of oppressive misery. Things have been much better. You know, and I actually have somebody that doesn't judge me, which, you know, that's another part of navigating through these different lives I've lived, is the very judgmental reactions whenever you attempt to engage in relationships or to, you know, get yourself a different job and things like this. Again, normal adult misery to my mind, but here's the problem. The PTSD never, ever went away. Very serious, very nasty bouts of depression. And, you know, I've kind of sanitized this a little bit because let's get back to the dirty stuff for a minute. You know, a couple of suicide attempts in my past where, again, I was surprised to wake up. The last time I attempted this was right in the midst of a, you know, your job, your home, your wife, your family, and all your money are gone. So deal with this again, Chuck. And I cracked and tried to take myself out. And that was, you know, what, 2004. I think the first time I made a very serious attempt, let's see, would be 1985, but not a lot of attempts. One, two, three. Three times I made serious attempts and one way or another was interrupted. And you know, after that last one, I had decided that under no circumstances could I do that again, because you know, one of these psychotherapists, and I do despise psychotherapists, made a very valid point, which was that that I was doing this and had done this a couple of times because my father taught me that with his actions, that, you know, an intolerable situation could be solved this way. And no matter what he said or did, or no matter the fact that, you know, the last thing he said to me is that it's time for you to go be a man, no matter all of that, no matter the good he did or anything else, that this was the lesson impressed upon me, whether I knew it or not, and that I was going to do that to my children if I did the same.
There's some logic behind that.
Some very good logic.
Yeah.
So here's the thing. All of this comes together, and I'm doing better, and I'm doing better, and I'm doing finally what I probably should have done many years earlier by doing this show, all right, and doing what it is I do, and I am pleased with that I can do this. But it never took away this thing that hangs on you. And PTSD is, God, people throw around this term now. I don't understand how they throw it around, because it's oppressive. And you know, the other honest thing that I don't like to be honest about is that, yeah, I do suffer from depression a lot. I think it's not a standalone symptom. I think it's part of this.
Yeah, it's definitely depression and PTSD go hand in hand.
And it doesn't go away. It's not just your weak. That's another thing, too. It's not a weakness psychologically.
No, it's not.
In fact, it's strength. And here's what it is. You literally reset the breakers in your brain and your mind to accommodate the absolutely intolerable. That is basically what happens to create what they call PTSD. I am satisfied with that definition. I know it may not be entirely clinical, but I'm telling you, that's what I experience.
You know, you put it in everyday language, which is perfectly fine, but no, you are 100% right. PTSD and what eventually rolls into PTSD is the result of your brain protecting itself.
But it literally alters your alters your brain.
Yeah, it alters the neural pathways. It does. I mean, your body, your brain is basically doing what it's supposed to do. It's protecting itself. And if you are in so much trauma, it goes through a lot of things to allow you to continue to function.
So how do you reckon with, you know, a 6-year-old boy being anally violated? How do you reckon with that? Guess what? This is how you reckon with it.
Yeah.
How do you reckon with somebody put a gun next to your head and popped it so that you can't hear out of your ear for a little while because they want to make sure that you know that they're in control? How do you reckon with that? How do you reckon with getting locked in closets? How do you reckon with spitting out flesh from your mouth and you don't know where it came from? How do you reckon with all of that when you're a child? Guess what? This is how. And it can go further than that. And when I get into the description about what I actually experienced during the psilocybin, going to reveal some stuff that might explain some other coping mechanisms that come into play too. But back to this weighs on me and always has weighed on me, and I don't recall what it feels like. There's two things I don't recall the feeling of. One of them is not being in pain without being medicated. I know what it is to use painkillers, and I know what it is to be in pain. I don't recall a sensation without one of those two things. I also can't recall what it was like. Like, I have memories of what happened before my father died, but I don't remember how I felt. It's too distant a memory. All I remember is dealing with this. Indulge me for a second here. It's like a feeling of I've got a wet blanket on my body. And that wet blanket sometimes is heavier and sometimes is lighter. And I need to be on guard at all times. And my mind cannot possibly rest a lot at night. Every dream is a nightmare. And there are sensations, I don't know how to describe. My guess is that they're pain and they're not physical. And they get heavier and heavier. And when something goes wrong, they get double, triple the weight that they were before. And you got to carry this. That's what it was like. And despite the fact that I had my son, who is a blessing to me, and I'm able to be here, you know, longer than I was with my other children already. And I'm actually an active participant raising him, despite the fact that I had a caring, loving partner, despite the fact that I was able to do something that I truly wanted to do, and that I've enjoyed the support of people who have been interested in it. Regardless of what it is you heard from my voice on this show, regardless of all that, what I'm telling you is that it was getting heavy enough on me, no matter what I did, no matter what I could experience, that I was starting to get immobilized emotionally, mentally, and I was feeling as though this was crushing me. Now, when you couple that with the fact that, to be honest with you, you hear me laugh sometimes, you hear me sound happy sometimes, but I got to be honest with you, I don't seem to experience happiness like other people do. I see other people be happy. I don't understand that. I have a numbness to me. And it works not just about, oh, gee, I'm not happy, but you know what else it works during is usually when something bad happens. I can very calmly and confidently handle horrible things because I have an emotional lock that keeps me kind of middle of the road most of the time. I think it's part of it. I'm not sure. But all I know is that there was a level of misery. So physical pain, carrying that wet blanket, carrying those weights, was getting to a point where, again, like I said, you know, in the initial part of this, if it would have destroyed my brain and taken my memories away, that would be fine. That would be fine. If it would have killed me, good. Because it ends. Now, again, I'm not saying I was suicidal, but I would have greeted death with a smile.
Yeah.
And I've been at that point other times, obviously. But this was despite anything that was happening. It didn't matter. That's where I was going. I really, when I say that the people that provided me with the stuff I needed here saved my life, they did, because I felt like I was really dying inside.
Yeah, well, I mean, it sounds like you were.
So, and I don't know what caused that. I got to be honest, I don't know what caused that, because to me, carrying this shit around has been normal.
Yeah.
For all my life. So why now? I don't get it. Why now?
You know? Believe it or not, it could partially be just an effect of everything going on around all of us.
I thought that too. Mm-hmm. You know, the general atmosphere because of the lockdown and the, yeah. Oh my God, there's a virus everywhere and people are afraid of each other and, you know, and people are divisive and they're fighting and all this crap that's gone on over the past couple of years. One could say the general atmosphere probably contributed to this.
Yeah.
But I don't accept that that's the answer.
No, I don't think I wasn't insinuating that it was. I think it, you know, it could have just been, you know, you reached the limit of what you could tolerate.
Again, though, you understand, it's like, again,
yeah.
You know, how many times am I supposed to hit the circuit breaker, pop it and turn it back on? That's where it was. And it's not like I was fighting with this. It was like I didn't even realize that I was sinking, to be honest with you. I just felt it and didn't know how to articulate it. But with all this being said, I mean, look, I leave it there because I think I've laid out all of it out. And the last part of what we're going to do tonight, I would rather that you ask some questions or make some observations, because I know you've listened to me carefully. And I appreciate you, man. This is a very, you know, strenuous task
I'm honored that you asked. So, you know, no need to thank me. I'm very happy to participate. You know, I think, like I was saying, I think, and you know, without drawing this all back to, you know, the current climate, I do think the current climate has to have played into it. I certainly don't think it was the reason, but I think, and then I'll move on from this point. But I think, like me, you're also seeing through a lot of kind of the consequences and the implications of what, you know, what we are all facing going forward.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's been laying very heavily on my mind. So that could just be, it could be me practicing transference, but no, and I think, you know, you said, you know, multiple times you kind of hit the circuit breaker, but I think that each time you had to do that, it was, you know, it worked and it got you through the next period of time, but I don't think it was ever I don't want to say permanent. I don't want to say permanent because that's what I'm looking for. I do think that for the right people, mm-hmm. that things, these psychedelic experiences really can go in and help you do a more lasting reset. You know, it's not going to take away the past, but I've dabbled in some low-level psychedelics. I've never done psilocybin myself. I think I inadvertently had some LSD back in my wild years, but so I don't have the personal experience to really draw on. But from, you know, my understanding of it, you know, it's able to affect your brain to the, you know, in such a way, I mean, therapeutically, that whether it gives you a new perspective, and I think this is where, you know, this is where I'm going to be more, you know, these are the, not more interested, but these are where I can probably come up with the more questions. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you feel now? But it's a more effective reset.
Well, let me just describe this real quick too, just thumbnail sketch again.
Sure.
You know, it's not as though I haven't. And here's the thing. I object to the psychotropic drugs. You've heard me say this kind of thing. The reason is they were abject failures for me. I was put on Prozac at an early age when it was still being advised against putting kids on Prozac. They put me on it. I've been given various regimens of, you know, big pharma chemicals to try mm-hmm. and deal with depression, to try and deal with PTSD, to try and deal with. I've been through various types of counseling. At one point, electroshock was considered for me, you know, due to the severity. I've been through mill. And I've tried the meditative approach. And make no mistake, that helped. You know, and at certain points, there were bits of counseling that assisted. You know, but it's like a 5% to 95% as far as success rate goes. With anybody who really seemed to pay attention to what was going on and wasn't trying to just write me a prescription.
Right.
You know, and that didn't matter when I was a kid or when I was in, you know, court-appointed therapy or whatever. It didn't matter. Or when I was incarcerated or hospitalized. Doesn't matter. There was almost nothing that ever did anything to this, that never actually did anything to depression. Of course, I skillfully learned, you know, the right things to say.
Oh, sure.
In order to, you know, get myself out of hospitalization or to reduce my jail time, or
of course.
I did that. Okay.
I would hope so. Anyone that, you know, anybody would.
Well, you learn how the game is played and you just say to yourself, look, okay, fine, I'll take your crap because I'm going to keep. Oh, of course, I'm going to take your stuff when I get out. It's so much better. No. You know, all that. So I had done that. I've tried every way I can to sort of, you know, logically to handle this other ways to my mind. And again, yeah, in recent years, I had no access to psychiatry for sure. And I overall do judge that entire field pretty poorly because they never were able to reach me, whether I was honest or I was gaming them. It really didn't matter. So it never helped me. And I've seen other people that, you know, they learn how to game it and that's the end of it,
mm-hmm.
you know, or they become reliant on some drug that they think is doing them a favor. And in the mm-hmm. long run, it doesn't, or in the short run, it doesn't,
right.
you know, like some of the people that killed themselves either intentionally or unintentionally that I knew, we're on psychotropic drugs.
Oh yeah, that's the big risk factor that nobody tells you about, is the increased risk of suicide on definitely the SSRI categories.
Yeah.
Some of the atypicals, I think, are a little safer in that respect. But yeah, there's a very high risk of suicide.
Another thing that is when they screw with your sleep cycles or they dope you into sleep. This is not good either. And I can tell you how I know this, because first of all, the drugs screwed up my sleep, screwed up my memory, did all kinds of things to me in the short run. But frankly, again, see, now here's another thing over this 8 years time with Mrs. O. Probably had not gotten myself a good night's sleep, except maybe a handful of times in 8 years. You know.
Yeah, you had told me that before.
I mean, I'm the guy who's waking up, hour and a half sleep, wake up, 2 hours sleep, wake up, on a good night. You know, and some nights it's like 3 hours. Yeah, okay, that's about all I'm getting. Doesn't mean I'm functional. I'm just laying there staring at a wall, right. Or you know, I mean, no matter what I do, and. It is what it is. So that kind of thing also is something that goes along with the PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, my whole life, my sleep cycle's been a mess. And I also seem to want to stay awake at night and sleep in the day. I've always been that way for some reason.
Let me ask you something.
Mm-hmm.
When in the worst part of the worst years of your childhood, where was it worse at night or during the day? Like, if something bad was going to happen, typically, was it happening during the daytime or the nighttime, or didn't it matter?
Well, nighttime. Nighttime was always the hardest.
That's exactly
show.
Why you're staying awake at night.
Right.
Your brain is trained to that. You have to be on guard at night. And
right.
That's exactly why.
And no, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, I say for some reason, right? I'm pleading ignorance here because I have theories. I have plenty of theories, you know, and I feel as though that's a valid one.
Yeah.
It may not be the only one. The other problem is that when I do actually get into a deep sleep, it is often disturbed by my own brain. I'm literally woke back up, and that may be, again, part of what you were saying, or something else.
Well, it could be, and, you know, And you said you've had brain MRIs?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Be interested to see. Because, you know, you said you multiple times you said you had, you know, it sounds like mild to moderate head trauma.
Yeah.
And, you know, most of us are perfectly fine after one, you know, maybe two minor head traumas. But you had multiple, and you had multiple at a young age.
Mm-hmm.
So that really begs the question, you know, is some of this?
Is it that?
Yeah. Well, I'm actually not thinking it's just that alone. I'm putting them together. I'm thinking, so you had all the trauma growing up and what you went through.
Mm-hmm.
Then you add in at a time when your brain was rapidly developing. Then you add in more than one occasion where you had a physical head injury.
Right.
You know, you put those together. Could easily explain
a lot
most
of this.
Most, if not all, of what's going on.
Well, severe depression. Even football players who get concussions repeatedly.
Oh yeah.
You know, have all sorts of. So you know, that's the thing. And you know what the funny part is? I didn't even focus on that when I was looking at the psilocybin. I didn't think about the head trauma at all. Because
you didn't really mention it much. I know you've mentioned it before.
Yeah.
But not a whole lot. So yeah, that actually sheds a lot of light there.
But see, here you go with it's hard on the inside doing this. This is why I really wish there was some more guidance out there about this.
Yeah.
Because honestly, I didn't even, it's like, it's so normal to me. Why am I even going to add that into, you know, symptoms? You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, it's like, yeah, I bet a bunch of people get, you know, lots of concussions and stuff and get their brains knocked around. Like, really? I mean, I know it sounds funny, but I mean, like, to me, I'm thinking to myself, oh, doesn't everybody have, like, you know, 6, 7, 8 documented concussions? I mean, you know.
I don't know that you give enough credit to how unique your, especially your early life was. I mean, and I'm not saying unique as in, you know, a wonderful way, but unique in the sense that, you know, probably not a whole lot of people that that, you know, could match you head to head on experiences. I mean, I would have to guess a lot of them probably aren't around to talk about it in their late 40s. Or if they are, they're just, you know, they have been so hardened that they never would talk. So my point is that, you know, I think you have so many cofactors adding into all this.
Mm-hmm.
That sheds a lot of light.
It does, but then again, there's probably some other elements here that I'm not even taking into account, right?
Let's throw something in you probably didn't think of at all. What kind of diet did you eat as a child? I mean, I can't imagine your mom was making, you know, cooking three meals a day and, you know, making sure you were well fed with fresh, healthy food, right?
No, I was one of those kids that was so pleased with the school lunch, mm-hmm. You know, because that was my meal of the day.
Yeah.
And I know physically, I've had dentists tell me I must have been malnourished based on the development of my teeth.
Sheds a little light on that too, because we were talking about we talked about some of the dental issues before. But yeah, you throw a developing brain in that type of environment without proper nutrition, mm-hmm. in you know, multiple mild to moderate head injuries. You know, I think we've put it all together.
Well, the fractured skull was pretty severe.
Well, no, that's...
You know, no. I'm just saying, like, you're saying mild to moderate. I don't even know how to gauge. Motor vehicle accident, when you hit a windshield, that's pretty severe, too. You know, it's the kind of thing that does do some damage, and quite frankly, it's not been fully quantified. It's been looked at. But I don't know, after I broke my neck, they didn't do the MRI on my head. It was on my, you know, they were focused on my neck.
They didn't look at the, that's interesting.
No, it wasn't about the brain injury, even though I came in complaining of the headache. And it was just like, well, let's x-ray. And they did just, you know, basic x-ray, and it was like, well, that's broken.
Oh, okay. Now I understand. Okay.
You
I
know,
gotcha.
So, yeah, you broke your neck. Okay. Again, you know, the cervical fracture. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, that's why my head hurts. Which is also how, and there was a time there where I got hooked on opiates, but it was through my doctor. Mind you, I never got hooked on any other drugs.
People end up getting hooked on opiates.
Yeah, I think I told you that during the break there, that I had not gotten hooked on any other, I mean, outside of cigarettes.
Right.
Which, environmentally speaking, you know, to my memory, there wasn't an adult that didn't smoke. So,
growing up, everybody smoked. I smoked. Everybody around me smoked.
Right. I started smoking, and I've been smoking now for 37 years because I started when I was 12. You know, my lungs, not in that bad a shape, despite having pneumonia a few times.
Yeah,
I got some scar tissue.
You know, it's very interesting because there are some people that they can smoke up. You know, they can smoke from the time they're 12 years old until they're 90, and they can die of something completely different with the healthiest heart and lungs you can find.
And then there's other people, 5 years of smoking, and, you know, 5 years after that, they develop lung cancer. I know it's interesting, and I wonder about my genetics. You know, I wonder about that package. But again, there's a lot of possible other factors here. Yeah, this is interesting, though. I didn't even think about the nutritional aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
I found it remarkable that, you know, John Barber made an observation on my show,
mm-hmm.
which is very valid, and I don't know where it goes because I'm having a hard time finding out about it. But it seems as though people with, like, rougher childhoods
mm-hmm.
are way more attracted to sugar.
Yes, I have heard that before.
And I don't know what it is, except that it must be to replace a neurological reaction that you get from sugar. And I'm one of those guys, I appreciate my sugar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I found it like that. He was like, you ever notice anybody with a sweet tooth, like, really, who likes their candy, their cake, their whatever, their soda, that they usually had a rough childhood?
Yep.
And I'm like, yeah, that's generally the case. Most people that, you know, are taken good care of and they seem to not be as interested in putting junk in their bodies. They're always a little healthier. You know, and I wonder about that, too, is that, you know, it wasn't the only time I was hungry as a kid. I wonder about the overall development, because your brain develops up until you're, what, 25, right?
25, yeah. Yeah.
So,
and you're, you know, in that time period from birth up until about, you know, 10 or 12 years old, that's when you're finishing the myelination of the nerves, and, you know, the coating on all the nerves and brain growth in it. I mean, the brain is just is developing so rapidly.
Right.
And yeah, you throw that nutrition in there too, and it's like, okay. So.
Yeah, so I mean, at best, you're talking about irregular nutrition for me, you know. But again, as I learned to earn money, what did I choose to eat? Well, I ate the roast beef sandwiches at the bar. I appreciated those. Mm-hmm. Then I started to do what? I bought junk food. I mean, I was a kid with money.
Of course.
So, you know, a cake, a sweet roll, you know. deli sandwiches, though, is something I've always loved. And that was like my... you know, my big taking care of myself thing, go and buy a sandwich made at a deli. Or at the bar, one way or the other. Best roast beef sandwich ever at that bar. I got to tell you, I've never been able to find one to match it. But even today, if I order a sub, man, I'm going to get myself roast beef and cheese. It's just what I
never
like.
I never liked roast beef as a deli meat. I'm a huge beef eater. But for some reason, I never like deli roast beef. I don't know why. If it's okay if it's mixed with other things, like if you're back when I ate subs, you know, if you had it like roast beef and some other deli meats, but on its own, it was never a big fan. Yeah. Now, give me a good corned beef or pastrami, totally different.
Oh, nothing wrong with those either. But I'm just saying, it's always, I don't know. It's been one of those. I'm just thinking back to my diet. You know, what were my staples? Potato chips, you know.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, how much protein? Because that's, you know, you need a ton of protein.
But that's where I got my helping. But that was my protein, and that was a treat, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So a lot of potato chips, crackers, you know, nonsense like that is what I got. And then, like I said, when I started to make my own money, I don't know. I think it was a lot of bread and cereal, really.
Yeah.
But it was
what it was. It goes a long way.
Well, and you know, again, my choice, my money. So,
yeah.
You know, what was I? No, nobody was advising me. You know, you should. I mean, I know they had those things on TV about, you know, go and eat the four food groups or whatever. But
right. Like,
I gave a crap. You know, I just wanted. I can buy this for myself. So I did.
Exactly.
You know, Twinkies.
Well, and at that point, it sounds like you. I mean, at that point, you were just better off because you were probably eating more regularly at that point.
Yeah. Well, and there were various things I did. I mean, there were certain points where I would help out the cafeteria workers to deliver lunches. Like, I was in a school where there was no cafeteria, so everybody got their lunch delivered to the classroom on a tray.
So that's interesting.
Kids that were absent, you know, their lunches didn't get eaten, but they were paid for. So at the end of delivering all the lunches, I would get a couple of these lunches from absent kids, and there was my lunch.
There you go.
You know, stuff like that. But I came up with an angle any which way I could to sustain myself, you know. So there you have it. But anyway, I don't know if you want to go any further on this, because we're coming toward the end of the second half.
Yeah. I can do a few more minutes. I can't do the full hour. I'm not going to do the full hour, though, because I got to get up in the morning. But we're going to do next Saturday night, correct?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we should maybe pull it together now, because I think we're definitely at the point where we can start to move on. I think you like I said on the break, I think you have painted a really good picture. And really set the stage well for the experience.
Well, effectively, what I'm trying to get across here, and I want you to tell me what your thoughts are, but
sure. The
thing is, there's a cumulative effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you are the sum of your experiences and your decisions,
mm-hmm.
right? And I know that, and some of that was not in my control. I get it, but the fact is that getting to the point where it was like, you know what, I got to do something. I was desperate, man. I was really in a state of desperation. And I don't know if I got that across really here, that somehow, you know, despite my best reckoning and trying to work my way through things and getting some of what I wanted out of life, and even, you know, reuniting with my kids, you know, which that's an awkward and developing situation. But either way, things were not bad. And still inside, I was just creeping into this desperation that, I mean, I've got a solid communication with Mrs. O, make no mistake. But there are certain things that I can't even articulate, believe it or not. I know I run my mouth constantly, but there are certain things, trying to articulate them from what's going on inside, I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to explain it. I don't know how to. And those are the things, honestly, that are probably the heaviest part of that wet blanket that was on me, is I don't know how to explain. And even as I'm sitting here trying to tell you, and I'm in a better place right now, a way better place, I still can't tell you. I still don't know how to put it into words.
Yeah, I mean, that we could go a little further with that in the future if you wanted.
Okay.
I'm certainly happy to do that. That would be interesting. I think that would be very interesting too, and that could then pave the way into talking about the experiences themselves. I don't want to say the finished product because it's not done, but you know, what's it looking like now for you? Mm-hmm. You know, I can tell in your voice that there's been, you know, there's certainly been progress. You know, that you've definitely gotten some benefit out of it.
Like the recent event here, with Kim going to the hospital, which again was a bit traumatic to me. I'm not trying to make it about me. I'm just saying.
That, of course it was.
You know, watching somebody go away to, in an ambulance, and that's a whole nightmare. Mm-hmm. And having that be the only person that you really trust in your life, and having that be the center of your life, you know, that was not easy. And I got to tell you something. If I had not done this before that, I'm very sure that I would not have internally handled it as well. I really feel like I might have ended up curled up in a ball for a bit over it. And
that's,
you know,
I
which is
that's...
weird, because I'm sure I can handle, listen, I can handle terrible.
Yeah, well.
In the moment. But I don't know the kind of wreckage that could have been left from that inside me afterwards. I don't know if I would have handled that or anything else after that as well. So that's, I don't know how to quantify that or explain that either. I just put it on the table. It's one of those things that's true.
Yeah, I talked to you the night that, that this all happened, and, you know, it was very obvious that the state you were in, but no, you,
I was upset, but in control. See, that's...
Yeah, yeah. No, that's what I meant. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to put it that way. I meant to say more, but the gravity of it was obviously apparent, but, you know, you were well in control when we talked.
Right.
You know, it was more questions and, you know, trying to figure out what just happened. You had the added problem of, you know, you couldn't really, you had Frankie, so it's not like you could have even had someone come and get you to follow her. Plus the hospital's, I mean, they're finally starting to let people bring someone into the emergency room in most places, but, you know, there's still,
yeah,
you know, these, some of these ridiculous policies. So there's that, you know, there's, so no, there was a lot of it, a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. No, there was a bunch to that, but I mean, I think I had a fairly average reaction to it for,
yeah, yeah,
for,
no,
the situation.
You weren't, you were very composed, and, you know, you seemed to be thinking clearly.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, which again, I'm not saying I wouldn't have been able to do that in the moment, but the aftermath of it would have hit me harder. I think, So I don't know how I would have gotten through it without having done this first. But obviously I didn't know this was coming.
But the universe works in mysterious ways.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I don't know if you want to just leave it there for tonight, and then
I think the next time
we can pick up from, well, what the actual experience was. And maybe get Mrs. O to join in, because, you know, she's the only person who actually observed what I was going through and communicated with me while I was going through it. So she may have a story to tell here.
She didn't give me too many details. I mean, when I would check in, you know, she didn't go into too many details when I would check in to see how you were doing, like the times that you had said you were going to do it. So I would check in with her, and no reports of you swinging from the ceiling or tap dancing or anything odd like that.
No, you know, there might have been something that could have been categorized as dance moves at one point, but we'll have to get into that in the next installment of this. But and I really want you to, you know, again, engage with questions and stuff. I don't know if I adequately laid this out and gave people the right impression so far, but I'm doing my best.
I think you're doing a hell of a job. No, I don't. I wouldn't worry about it. I really think you have laid it out.
Okay. So
I think you've laid it out very clearly.
Fair enough. So until we get into the next part, I mean, if you got any other questions about the foundational reasons for this or any other input, I mean, by all means, I find it fascinating that, you know, first of all, I didn't correlate the head injury issue. Although there's some interesting stuff to be said about that in the next part, you know, and this other concept of, you know, what the nutritional circumstance might have been, which I, again, did not consider.
And you were growing up in North Jersey, so it's not like you had the cleanest air in the world, and this was the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah, 70s and 80s, and it was, you know, but then again, here I go again, right? It wasn't so bad, because it was along the shore, you see. So as long as you weren't, you know, swimming in the medical waste, you were doing okay.
I remember spending summers in Cape May with my aunt, and going to the Delaware Bay, and all the signs up, so basically skull and crossbones, don't go anywhere near this water.
Yeah, well, you know, look, I was in Long Branch is the first town that I spent, you know, any time in. Mm-hmm. Long Branch, New Jersey, which is right on the shore.
Yep.
You know, places like Ocean Grove and Manasquan and Neptune, which is just off the shore, Asbury Park, I think I mentioned that already, you know, Bradley Beach, different places, Bayhead, you know, a couple different areas like that, and then you go up north a little bit, and yeah, it is kind of more polluted, but it wasn't the worst air, I don't think, and there was the beach and the boardwalks and, you know, I mean, look, beautiful place to be. I miss Jersey. I really do.
Yeah. I love Jersey. I actually did. I just, you know, obviously I wasn't born there. I just spent a ton of time there growing up. Mm-hmm. I've always liked New Jersey. Now I just, I can't afford Maryland. So I'm not out loud to afford New Jersey.
Jersey's expensive, boy. Yeah. It really is.
And I mean, yeah. Trust me, when Maryland is not cheap either, especially the area that I'm in. But yeah, that's a whole other story.
No, I got you. Anyway, so I guess we'll leave this at where we're at, unless you got other questions.
No, I don't. Did you ever find Hesher?
Did I ever find? What do you mean?
Didn't he not show up for you on Monday night?
Oh, you know what happened is he ended up in. He told me ahead of time that he was going to end up in a place that he wasn't sure if he could connect, so he was going to try to get his Skype to work wherever he was going to be at that time.
Oh, gotcha.
And
okay.
It turned out he like had no internet access to speak of, so he couldn't get to me, and so I just kind of rolled with it, like, well, maybe he'll show up, and he didn't. So, but you know what? It turned out good because we ended up with the 2 hours with Terry, which I didn't expect at all.
Oh, and your hour on your own wasn't bad either.
Oh yeah, well, if you have the members section or you're on Patreon, you got the other hour in podcast, or you heard it live, one or the other. Because I cut it down to Terry's story because there was no way I was cutting that. I think that was really cool.
I have to get
cool.
to that. I'm kind of behind.
No worries. Your
podcast, and I got about four other ones that I keep up with.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, lately I've been so damn busy.
Well, and I do put out a lot of stuff, so I mean, you know, it sometimes takes time.
You're fine. You're fine. No, I keep up with yours, and I won't promote any other podcasters. But
well, I appreciate it, man. Look, I want to thank you again for going through this with me, and again, like
anytime.
I said, we're going to do two more parts. The next part will be about the experience itself, the actual process. Which, again, I am not giving any sort of advice in any way, shape, or form for anybody to do what I did. I'm merely telling my story. And then in the third part, I intend to discuss in full what the positive results were. And there are, spoiler there, positive results to this. But again, I'm still not telling you to do this. I am not giving you advice. Neither is Captain Trips. We are not doing this.
And this is, you know, like I've said, there's certainly recreational value, but I think the therapeutic value is much more important.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, you know, it's something I think to be respected.
Well, I'll give you one other teaser. Is the majority of what I did not really enjoy recreationally.
I believe that.
Was brief times where there was some enjoyment in there, but the majority of the time spent was actually not enjoyable. But
sounds like the experience a lot of people have reported with ayahuasca.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a life changing experience, and they would absolutely do it again if given the option. But you know, they said the actual experience of the ayahuasca isn't very pleasant.
Mm-hmm. No, a good deal of this was absolutely not pleasant. But that is the story for next time, isn't it? Anyway,
yep.
Again, Captain Trips, a very special thing. We're going to get back together next Saturday and go into the experience itself. And like I said, this will be in at least three parts. So thanks again, man. I really appreciate you doing this with me. And can't wait to hear what questions you have for the next part, because I'm sure you're going to have a bunch more to say, actually, in the next episode.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely will, and I can digest some of these new things that we threw in here, you know, the nutrition and the head injuries. And but, yeah, I will definitely have more questions. Because you told me some bits and pieces of the experience, but I'm very interested to hear, you know, your accounts of the experience, and you know, especially if you could. And here's I'm gonna leave you with a question. Do you remember, or could you pinpoint at times during the experience where you think it helped you?
So that'll
be interesting to hear if that's something you're comfortable sharing.
Well, we're gonna see next time, Captain Trips. Thanks, everybody.